We're talking about Wisconsin's downtown districts and how to keep them thriving. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Wausau River District received the Great American Main Street Award recently. That's a national award recognizing revitalization and commercial district growth. We're looking at how Main Streets are doing across Wisconsin and what Wausau is getting right. Over the past 4 years, the Wausau River District introduced dozens of new programs that generated more than $8 million in local spending. What does your downtown area look like in your community? What has changed in recent years to improve foot traffic? Do you have any issues with recent changes, and what has yet to be improved? We're at 800-642-1234. Aaron Welty is coordinator for the Wisconsin Main Street Program and Downtown Development Program Manager for the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. Aaron, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Well, let's look at Wisconsin as a whole first and the developments happening in downtown areas. You have these commercial districts, you have river districts. What is the distinction? What's the difference between them?
Sure. I mean, everybody has a downtown. You know, it's the heart of your community, whatever that might look like. We have run the Wisconsin Main Street program. And so those are communities. There are 34 of them around the state. And they're communities that have a full-time director, that have a dedicated organization, and that are really full-heartedly pursuing downtown revitalization. But we also have another 75 communities that are part of our affiliate program. They're doing downtown work. They're working towards revitalization on a volunteer basis at the municipal level. And then there's all the other folks that are, you know, trying locally to do what they can. So they're all inspirational stories.
Who are these communities generally trying to attract when they build these downtowns and really try to draw people in?
Well, the benefit of downtowns is that they're for everybody. I mean, downtowns are really the place where everybody can go and mingle and interact, and that's not really true in anywhere else in our lives. You know, you're at your kids' sports games with the kids with 8-year-olds, or you're at church with the people who are there. But downtowns are really for everybody. They're usually walkable, so they, you know, suit all ages from 8 to 80. But they're really, you know, in terms of new apartments and things that are going up, certainly we see a lot of empty nesters and millennials moving in because they don't want the house in the yard, but they do want the coffee shops and the wine bars. So they're certainly attracted.
Oh, so you're kind of building more of a sense of community and certainly drawing people in to live and work, play?
Yeah, I mean, live, work, play is a kind of trite tagline at this point, but it's really true. I mean, people can spend 24/7 in a downtown.
So how important are downtowns when it comes to tourism in our state?
Downtowns are really a critical point. I mean, it's an identity. That's what you remember when you visit a community. You've never gone through and been like, that's the community with the great strip mall. I need to go back there. Maybe an outlet mall. But usually it's what you remember about a community. It's kind of the identity. But there are a lot of people who are pursuing cultural or shopping tourism where they're focused on downtowns because that's where those unique shops are. That's where the cultural heritage museums usually are. So it is kind of the destination for a certain group as well.
And if you're on the banks of a river and your downtown is overlooking some really gorgeous scenery, that can also be a feather in your cap.
Oh yeah, if you can mountain bike or raft and then go for your beer or your coffee, that's a double whammy.
So you're part of the Wisconsin Main Street program, which started in 1988. Can you help us understand a little bit more what this program does?
Sure. So we were formed, the National Main Street Center formed in 1987 to promote downtown revitalization as a response to the malls that were cropping up around the country. So Wisconsin formed their program in 88. We had five initial communities. But what we provide is really technical support and assistance to communities that are trying to do this. So we'll bring in consultants. We'll look at branding, which is how the River District got its name originally. We'll look at streetscape. We'll look at parks. We'll look at placemaking, whatever it is that that community wants to do. We're there to kind of help provide resources to move that forward.
What is placemaking?
Placemaking is the art and science of making places where people want to be. So it's everything that's temporary, everything that's activation, you know, pop-up shops or giant chessboards in your park. Those are all placemaking.
What are you currently seeing in downtowns that are really working to attract people, attracting tourists? What's working right now?
The more authentic a community can be, the more successful they're going to be. Those that are just focused on tourists these days are looking for that authentic experience, and they don't necessarily want to be catered to as tourists. I mean, if you're the Dells, that's great. But even the Dells is trying to do a river walk and a more authentic local experience. So it's something that, you know, if you focus on what makes you unique and what drew people to you in the first place, your river or your train or your, you know, flowers or your agriculture, that's what people are hoping to see a glimpse of.
We're talking with Erin Welty. She's coordinator for the Wisconsin Main Street Program for the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. As we talk about Main Street programs and river districts here in Wisconsin, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a small business owner who has a storefront in a downtown area of Wisconsin? Why did you choose this location? How does your community help small businesses grow and continue? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So when we look specifically at a river district like Wausau, what do you see there? It's just won this Great American Main Street Award. What is going on in Wausau?
I mean, Wausau's hitting on all cylinders. They are building new housing. They are repurposing their older buildings. They just opened a distillery and a former train station. They have the Whitewater Park that you mentioned is a great outdoor amenity. They have the 400 block. They have a strong event series. So they have something for everybody, and there's always new things to explore. There's, you know, things popping up and changing, and they do a great job with the placemaking activities as well. They have the painted pianos that are out. They have the umbrellas that dance over their Third Street. So it's very unique and memorable when people are visiting.
Is this a long time in the making? Communities can't just do this overnight.
They can't. A lot of people really want them. What's the one thing that we can do that'll turn everything around? But your downtown wasn't built in a year or 5 years, and it's not going to change completely in that time either. So they've been at it for quite a long time. We have three of our original five that joined in 88 are still part of the program. It's a constant project.
And so tell us a little bit about the history with Wausau. It started the River District in 2002?
Yes. Yep. That's when they joined our program.
They
began a few years before that.
And so that really helped them start just growing this concept of a river district and what that could mean to them?
Yeah, the Main Street program provides some structure and some guidance in terms of how to set up your organization and your work groups and your efforts to kind of have that holistic approach. So you're doing promotions, you have a strong board, you're doing economic development, because if it's just pretty or you just have events and there's no stores to shop at, you don't have a vibrant downtown. So it's making sure all those pieces are being addressed together.
And so other parts of Wisconsin have also won this award in the past decades. We've got Beloit, Green Bay, La Crosse, Chippewa Falls. Are these communities still thriving today?
They are, and they are all still part of our program today. Sheboygan Falls is the other one. So, yes. Yep, they're all going strong and doing really cool things. I was in Beloit just on Friday and saw their new co-working space made out of shipping containers, which is one of the coolest things I've seen in a while. So they're still innovating.
Sounds like these downtowns have to be quite creative.
Yeah, I mean, you're always looking to provide that unique experience and do something different and new. You know, there's not one thing where if you copy what somebody else has done, that's going to be successful for you. It's what can we do here that's different and works for us.
We're talking about Wisconsin Main Streets and efforts to revitalize downtowns. Erin Welty is our guide. She coordinates the Wisconsin Main Street Program for Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. You can join in 800-642-1234. Is there a particular downtown or commercial district or river district that you love, love, love in Wisconsin? What makes it special? Where could there be additional changes when it comes to downtowns and river districts? What do you want to see happen to your downtown? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick this up in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're looking at downtown development, checking in on Main Streets here in Wisconsin on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A national jury of community and economic development people and historic preservationists selected the Wausau River District for this year's Great American Main Street Award. The two other winners were Portland, Oregon, and Wheeling, West Virginia. WASA joins Sheboygan Falls, Chippewa Falls, La Crosse, Green Bay, and Beloit that have received this award in the past, dating back to the mid-90s. Are you a small business owner who has a storefront in a downtown area? Why did you choose that location? How does your community help small businesses grow and thrive? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Erin Welty stays with us from the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, where she is Downtown Development Program Manager. So, Erin, right now we're seeing brick-and-mortar stores closing all over the place, big box stores closing at the malls, and that impacts Main Street as these businesses are also close to downtown. Some might even be in downtown. How are Main Streets keeping up their occupancy when so much business is being driven online?
Yeah, it's certainly a changing environment, that's for sure. I just actually completed a new entrepreneurship study of downtown, and we did find that we had more businesses opening in the last 3 years than previous, and each year increasingly so. And it's really driven by, you know, I call them second career entrepreneurs, people who are retired and they always wanted to open that coffee shop, or they always wanted to, you know, make wine or whatever. So we have a lot of those opening. And then we also have a lot of younger entrepreneurs. They might not be your shoe store or your typical retailer that you think of, but they are offering a unique experience or product. And, you know, those small, affordable spaces downtown really provide the venue for them to do that.
So there's real estate in downtowns that are there, and you're saying that it is affordable real estate.
Typically, if you have a 100-year-old building, you have the mortgage paid, and you can afford to take risks with those smaller spaces and really, you know, help entrepreneurs get their start.
And these are niche businesses that are popping up in downtowns?
Often. I mean, we do have some that are more typical. You know, we have lots of, you know, service providers, insurance agents, and hairstylists and whatnot. But we also have a lot of new innovative businesses. So businesses that's a running store that also has post-run beer groups, that also runs running groups out of the store, or a bike shop that also has, you know, coffee shop, one just opened in Verona. So there, it's kind of everything to cater to your audience. Who's your demographic and what do all those people need? And let's do all of those things and make this a hub for them.
So you're kind of a blending different areas, biking, coffee, things like that, like merging.
Merging things that all have the same demographic and different revenue streams. So if you're trying to make it work, you're not relying just on retail, but you have other things going on.
You're in the thick of so many main streets here in Wisconsin. How do small businesses help an area's economy thrive and keep going?
Well, they provide jobs, and they recycle the money within the community. So if I'm spending my money online, it's literally shit going somewhere else and not coming back. But those small business owners are the ones that are supporting the Booster Club and buying costumes for the play or sewing costumes for the play. So it's really kind of at the core of the local economy. And it is the community's identity. If you drive into a district and it's thriving, you get the perspective that community is thriving. So not only do they help support the economy, that they help support the image of the economy, which is really important when you're looking to recruit folks.
And you have a number of tools in your toolbox, so to speak, for the Main Street program to help these businesses grow in terms of merchandising and storefront design. What are some things that you offer?
Yeah, we really listen to our communities and to the businesses and say, what is it that you're looking for? We did just bring Retail Works to a bunch of our Southeast communities to provide hands-on assistance to businesses for merchandising and kind of storefront design to help them attract those customers, push those sales. But we've also done things for streetscape. We've also done succession planning for the older business owners that want to retire, but the community doesn't want to lose their pharmacy. That has been a really popular program. But really, whatever it is that those communities are needing. We just put some money into the Kiva crowdfunded loan program to help support projects by our local entrepreneurs because that was something they identified. So,
going back to succession, are there a number of businesses out there that are at that point where they're changing hands to the next generation? How is that going?
It depends. I mean, there's an increasing number who are getting to that point, but getting them to plan ahead has been a challenge. You know, you need to start planning 5 years ahead, and so often something happens unexpectedly that maybe, you know, takes things out of left field. So there are certainly examples of communities and businesses that have found a second generation, whether that's a child or not, or businesses that have gone to employee ownership or that have made that transition in a concise and strategic way. But there are others that, you know, someone gets ill and that's kind of the end of it. And that's really sad.
I bet what you don't want to see is we're closing, we're retiring, we're closing, and that's it. Yeah, because that's a business that's gone then.
Yeah. I mean, we did have a community where within a period of months, three businesses, one of their husbands died, one of their sons got sick, and one of them decided to retire to Arizona, that they'd had enough of Wisconsin winters. And it was really a difficult thing for the community. And they were able to bounce back, and one of the businesses sold and one repopulated. But yeah, it's better to do it in a planned fashion than kind of overnight.
Talking with Erin Welty, she's coordinator for the Wisconsin Main Street Program, and she's Downtown Development Program Manager for the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. As we take a look at Main Streets in Wisconsin and how they're growing and thriving. And another thing that I want to ask you about, Erin, is TIF districts, which stands for Tax Increment Financing. And according to the Revenue Department, there were just over 1,200 TIF districts in Wisconsin at the end of last year. Do TIF districts make an impact on Main Street development?
They certainly can. There's a couple reasons communities put them in place. One, if you're going to have some of these newer infill senior housing or other housing projects, the additional increment from those projects can really support some of these streetscape or loan funds to help renovate older historic buildings that maybe haven't had the TLC over time. And that can really be a catalyst for some of these other owners to have a revenue stream. We know that lots of people coming into downtown are undercapitalized, and that's certainly a way local communities can provide some capital that gets paid back that kind of helps with that. And others are really just driven by a desire to support and recruit new development to fill gaps maybe from a fire or a factory that doesn't exist anymore.
Well, when you say undercapitalized, we know that starting a small business, is risky, and you need front-end money. You need that capital going in to start that business. Is that capital there right now in Main Street, Wisconsin?
It's starting to be a little bit more. There was a period where it was very difficult to find funds, which is, you know, always a challenge. And going in undercapitalized is certainly a way to not succeed in the long term. But there are some communities that have really put together a whole gamut of programs that are available, whether that's, you know, brick and mortar improvement programs or white box programs. Racine in Milwaukee has some really good white box programs that help you finish out a space so that you're not living with shag carpeting or have the funds to remodel maybe a 50s era
store. So literally white box.
Literally white box. So there's some innovative stuff out there.
And when you look at many of these downtowns, aging infrastructure, these 100-year-old or more buildings, that too can be a challenge because you're looking at a very old building.
It can. I mean, nothing is square and nothing is predictable. But we also find that in terms of residential and leasing, people are willing to pay twice as much more for that historic and unique architecture. So it is a value, but you have to put the money in to get the money out. And finding a source for that funds to help support that renovation upfront is important. We did a study of businesses that had renovated their spaces to demonstrate what the impact to their businesses are, and realized that 2/3 of those businesses that had done so were able to translate that into, or 80% were able to translate that into new revenues and customers, but 2/3 required some sort of local funding program to help make that project happen, because otherwise they'd be saving for 10 years if it was just out of business revenues to make it happen.
Erin, not every community can be a Main Street community. You have to take, there are steps in order, there's an application process, there's front-end money that you need. If a community wants to become a Main Street, what is that step?
Yeah, it's not something you can jump into overnight. So we created the Connect Communities program in 2013-14, recognizing that communities can't go from 0 to 60, but we want to help them along the way. And there's plenty of communities that are volunteer-run merchant organizations or municipal staff that's recognized the value that are joining that program. That's kind of allows you to take advantage of some of our resources, recognizing that you're not going to, you know, do some of the bigger projects right away, but at least you can receive the training and the expertise that way.
As we start to wrap up here, what do you love about working all over Wisconsin with these Main Streets?
I tell people my job is to work in cute communities and work with great small businesses and property owners. So it's always different and every project is unique, but you can see the change.
Erin, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course.
Erin Welty is coordinator for the Wisconsin Main Street Program and Downtown Development Program Manager for the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. Coming up, we talk about the ACT and SAT and the impact these two tests have on setting the course for college-bound young adults in America. And it's your observations on standardized testing. You can join in with your experience at 800-642-1234. That conversation is coming up after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about college entrance exams, ACT, SAT, here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. College testing is a billion-dollar industry, and for decades now, college admission tests have had this outsized role at colleges as they choose whom to admit and whom to reject. Millions of students take the ACT or SAT each year. And in the fallout from the nationwide college admissions cheating scandal, we're taking a closer look at the role of these college entrance exams. Are you gearing up to take the SAT or ACT? Is your son or daughter starting to prep for them? Or are you preparing your child to go to a college where they don't place as much emphasis on these scores? Join in at 800-642-1234. Howard Everson is co-director of assessment in the Center for Technology and Learning at SRI International. That's a nonprofit research firm. And he designs and develops assessments to evaluate students in science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM, as it's often called. He previously directed research for the College Board and Educational Testing Service. Howard, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Happy to be here.
How did the SAT and the ACT become such an integral part of college admissions in the first place?
Well, it began largely after World War II, when there was a real expansion of college going in the United States, fueled largely by the GI Bill in the late 1940s and early 1950s. And that put a lot of pressure on colleges and universities around the country to begin selecting applicants for admission. And they needed along the way an objective measure of college readiness, for lack of a better word, that could be used to handle this swelling and growing admissions bubble in the United States. It's very difficult for colleges to assess the quality of the grades and the academic background of children from, you know, over 100,000 high schools in the United States. And so so a uniform sort of standardized measure was needed. And many of the colleges in the United States for a very, very long time used either the ACT or the SAT as part of that admissions and evaluation process for selecting candidates for admission. Many more, and today, and the growth in college admissions continues to today. We see the numbers are about 2 million high school students each year take either the SAT or the ACT or both in preparation for going to college.
Howard, what are these tests designed to evaluate? I mean, what is the mission here for these tests?
Well, generally, they're meant to give the colleges and the universities information and an assessment of the verbal ability and reading comprehension skills of students coming in, as well as their general knowledge and understanding of mostly high school mathematics, generally speaking. I don't think the tests measure much more than early algebra or beginning algebra. And they're designed to give the schools that kind of background on the students, and to estimate how well, in some ways, to give some estimation of how well they'll do in their first year on campus at the university or the college.
Are they a good predictor of college performance?
They're reasonably good. They shouldn't be used alone. They're not the single best predictor, and most colleges and universities use other information, mostly high school GPAs, grade point averages, letters of recommendation, performance on advanced placement tests and the like when they make their admissions decisions. But they serve a reasonably good role in having a general measure that is applicable across, as I said, across all high schools and both public and private high schools in the country.
So a general measure, and there's more information that could really help fill in the blanks as to how a student will do in a particular situation at a particular college.
That's right, and most admissions committees in the United States, in the colleges and universities across the country, do require or collect additional information, maybe letters of recommendation from high school faculty and college counselors at the high school level, as well as students' essays, written essays, and things of that nature. They also look, I think, very broadly across the course-taking patterns of the students who are seeking admission. I think they do the best they can to evaluate the rigor and academic value of the courses that they've taken at high schools. But it's important to keep in mind, in the United States, the quality of high school education varies considerably from state to state, county to county. And so it's quite a challenge to try to figure out from the thousands of applicants, maybe the hundreds or the maybe 1,500 or so that any particular school will take in a given year.
Talking with Howard Everson, who's co-director of assessment in the Center for Technology and Learning at SRI International. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Would you prefer colleges move to perhaps a portfolio-style admissions process? That is, where more of an emphasis is placed on how a student performed in school? Or do you see pitfalls there? Did you take the ACT or SAT? What do you remember? Call in at 800-642-1234. 1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Howard, what is the difference? Is it nuanced between the ACT and the SAT? Why would a student want to take one versus the other?
Yeah, the difference between the two is very subtle, and the correlation in the scores, that is the sort of the statistical and mathematical relationship between the scores, is quite high. They started out with two different philosophies back in the late 1950s or early 1960s or so, when the ACT started to grow in prominence. And the ACT was designed to be a bit closer, to measure much more closely the actual curriculum that's taught in secondary schools, as best as the ACT could represent that. And the SAT began largely as an aptitude test, so it was designed to be somewhat neutral to the high school curriculum. The philosophy being that there was no one uniform high school curriculum, and that what was needed was a broader measure of students' aptitude for higher education. And so, but they've grown similarly over the years, and I don't think the general public would actually know the difference between either the ACT or the SAT if they just saw the questions and nothing else.
Regardless of which path you take, you're going to be charged fees to take each test, and the cost can really mount. There's even a cost if you want to take the essay portion. You're looking at fees like $48 and $67. Why does it cost this kind of money to take these tests?
Well, the whole operation of administering tests to millions of students, and I think the last estimate I saw was something like 2.3 or 4 million students took the either the ACT or the SAT, as I said earlier, or both. Actually, many students today take both. And there's lots of costs related to the development of the test. Both the College Board, ETS, College Board, and ACT reinvest quite a lot of money in research to maintain the quality of the tests, because the tests have play such an important role in higher education. And so much of the costs go to just processing and collecting the test scores and having them scored, and then the score reports being redistributed around the country. And some portion of those fees go back for reinvestment. Both the College Board and ACT and ETS, for that matter, are all not-for-profit organizations, and so they have a legal mandate to reinvest the funds that they earn through these programs back into the improvement of the testing programs.
Let's go to Dave now, joining us from Kenosha. Hi, Dave. What's on your mind?
Hi. I heard you just bring up this portfolio idea, and I'm an elementary teacher in Illinois, but I live in Wisconsin, and I've heard the portfolio thing be spoken about from elementary level teachers to high school level teachers, and I think across the board I don't want to speak for all teachers, but I feel like a portfolio option would at least really help out students in struggling schools, especially in struggling. I know that he had brought up that high schools across the country across the states have very, very varying rates of success and whatnot. And I feel like, especially for those students in those low income districts with schools that are struggling, a portfolio would really, for the students that really want to go to college and are working very hard, a portfolio is more honest to what they're doing and their growth over time.
Just Howard, thank you, Dave. Howard, what are your thoughts on a portfolio-based system?
Well, in many ways, I agree with David, in that portfolios may give a broader picture of what the student's capabilities and prior achievement may be. The challenge with portfolios is to provide some uniformity or standardization of the scoring of them, so that the scores can be relied upon, can be trusted, and that there would not be any real variation in the scoring from school to school.
We're talking about college admissions exams in the wake of the college admissions bribery scandal, looking at the role of the ACT and SAT. Howard Everson is our guide. He co-directs assessment research at SRI International. You can join in 800-642-1234. Are you one of these students who perform differently in schools than on tests? How has that helped or hurt you? Call in, tweet us. We'll get back to the conversation in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the ACT and SAT on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The college admission scandal has swept up celebrities and business leaders, college athletic coaches. They're accused of paying off college officials and arranging for fake admission scores to get their children into elite universities. Here's the FBI announcing the investigation at a press conference last month.
We have charged three people who organized these scams, two SAT or ACT exam administrators, one exam proctor, one college administrator, nine coaches at elite schools, and 33 parents who paid enormous sums.
Do you think the ACT and SAT are good predictors of college readiness? Why do you think some students do better in school than on these entrance exams? Do you see a larger issue in the college admissions process? We're at 800-642-1234. Howard Everson is our guide. He co-directs assessment research at SRI International. Let's go back to the phones now with Dee joining us from Oak Creek. Hi, Dee.
Hi. I just wanted to say I graduated in 1977, never took the SAT or the ACT test, went back to college as an adult in my 20s and then later again in my 30s and did just fine. I don't think ACT and SAT tests are good predictors of how anybody is going to do in college.
Dee, when you went back to school in your 20s and 30s, did you have to take a standardized test?
I took a college entrance test, and that was it. So I was raising a family. I was working and going to college, and you had to make the grades. And I think it's all about how bad do you want it versus how well you're going to do on a test. That's just a one-time thing. I am a teacher, and I see how kids do on those tests. If you're not committed to the test and some aren't, how is that a good predictor on how well they're going to do after high school when they really want something? So,
well, I think
kids get tested to death.
D is bringing up several things here, Howard. One is that grit and how, you know, perhaps how badly they want those grades. And also that she says, you know, kids are tested to death.
Yeah, I don't agree with the caller. I think that tests play a very important role in helping with the sorting and the selecting that has to go on in this what amounts to be a major enterprise. And I do agree, on the other hand, that issues like grit and determination and aspirations are all very, very important. But in terms of what the big sweep of things, if you look at it sort of from a national perspective, there has to be some ways to help the colleges and universities not only make the admissions decisions, but then ensure that the students are placed in the right curriculum and the right series of courses. And Dee even says that, you know, even when she returned to school, she did take some college entrance test. It was probably most likely a placement test, which helped the college and the college counselors help her choose the right sequence of courses and curriculum for her to study. So they have an enduring value. Standardized tests are used all over the world. They're used for entrance and placement into the military and onto many civil service exams are built around the general idea of standardized testing. So they do serve a very important purpose for talent identification and the nurturing and the investment that colleges and universities have to make in developing and nurturing the talent of our youngsters.
Well, let's talk about the college admissions bribery scandal. Yesterday, actress Lori Loughlin pled not guilty. She was among a number of parents who have paid thousands of dollars to get their kids into college. Some paid thousands of dollars to pump up their kids' ACT and SAT scores. What does this gaming of the system suggest to you about these assessments and the admissions process?
Yeah, this is a troubling series of events. One of the first things that it tells me is that placement into or acceptance into some of the elite colleges around the country is highly sought after. And it also tells us quite plainly about the uneven playing field and the role that wealth and access to resources play in this whole process. And it's troublesome in the sense that the testing programs are meant to provide a fair and honest degree of assessment of the children's backgrounds and abilities, academic abilities. And now they're being turned into some sort of contest where people rely on test prep companies and proctors and other forms of ways to sort of to get around the testing program and in many ways inflate their scores for purposes of gathering admission. It's really the competition is quite ubiquitous around the country, particularly for the elite colleges and universities, you know, the Stanfords and the Ivy League colleges and around the country. They're thousands and thousands of applicants to those schools, tens of thousands in many cases.
Do you think this is tip of the iceberg? Are there more indictments out there? Is this scandal still going to be getting bigger?
I hope not, but I do worry about the broad nature of it. We have lots of supplementary and ancillary industries around test preparation all over the country. And I'm not sure that that's the best education for young students to get. I understand the desire to improve their scores and be competitive, but I'm not really sure that's the best way to prepare for success in college.
We heard from Jan from Northeast Wisconsin Technical College, and she says an article in the Chronicle of Higher Education indicates that many colleges and universities are moving away from using the ACT and SAT because of the cost and inherent bias against applicants of color and those from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. What are your thoughts on bias?
Well, I don't believe that the tests themselves are biased. And I've studied this rather extensively in my career. The source of the differences among and between groups in the United States is largely comes from the backgrounds and the from the high schools and elementary and high schools in the counties and districts in which they live. We know that American education is not equal across the board, and a lot of it, the quality of your education in many instances is determined by where you live and the resources in the counties and cities and states in which students live. It is an uneven playing field in that respect.
Well, it sounds like you're saying this is not the problem of the assessments. We're here to assess. We can't help that kids get an unequal education across America.
Well, that's largely the message. I think the College Board and ACT do the best they can to try to help level that playing field, but we are starting with a very troublesome and unequal education system in the United States, and now with mobility across the country, where kids from California are applying to schools in the Northeast and vice versa, there's lots of movement around, and the colleges and universities have a real challenge before them to try to figure out who to select and from which schools and how to help sort the students in ways that achieve more educational equality and opportunity in the United States.
Well, thank you, Howard, for joining us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Howard Everson is co-director of assessment in the Center for Technology and Learning at the research center SRI International. That's a nonprofit research and technology firm. He designs and develops assessments to evaluate students in STEM areas, previously directed research for the College Board and Educational Testing Service. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.